If I asked you to close your eyes right now and picture the absolute cutting edge of future technology, what pops into your head?
Let me guess.
You're probably seeing, quantum computers, maybe shimmering graphene sheets, or bioengineered polymers.
Right.
I'm willing to bet a substantial amount of money that steel is not on your list.
That is a very safe bet. We tend to think of steel as, well, solved.
Solved, yeah.
It's the stuff of the 19th century. We built the railways and the Eiffel Tower with it. It feels like old news, doesn't it?
Exactly. It's the heavy, dirty stuff we moved on from. We drive past it every day and don't give it a second thought.
No.
But we have a stack of research here today that suggests we are completely wrong about that.
We really are.
We are looking at a PhD thesis by Christopher Neil Holmesmith from the University of Cambridge, and it turns out steel is still a massive frontier for material science.
It really is. The thesis is titled "The Thermal Stability of Bulk Nanocrystalline Steels." And honestly, it reads like a detective novel for metallurgists.
A detective novel. I like that.
It challenges a lot of textbook assumptions. We are still discovering things about how iron and carbon interact at the atomic level that are surprisingly complex.
And the star of this show is a specific material that has arguably the coolest name in metallurgy.
Oh, this is a good one.
Superbainite.
It is a catchy name, but the material itself is even more impressive than the branding.
Okay.
It's incredibly strong, incredibly tough, and relatively cheap to make.
But, and there is always a but, in these deep dives, this supermaterial has a fatal flaw, a kryptonite, if you will. The mission of this deep dive is to follow the detective story in this thesis. We're going to find out why this material, which is strong enough to stop bullets, falls apart if you just get it a little bit hot.
And just to clarify, by falls apart, we don't mean it melts into a puddle.
Right.
We mean it self-destructs from the inside out. Its
Yeah.
internal architecture, its whole microstructure just collapses.
Okay. So, we are going to look at the crime scene of the microstructure, look at the failed attempts to fix it, and finally, the ingenious solution the researcher found to make this steel survivor ready for a jet engine.
It's a classic engineering trade-off. How do you keep the properties you fought so hard to get while eliminating the one weakness that makes the material, well, useless?
So, let's start at the beginning. What exactly is nanocrystalline bainite or superbainite? Because the thesis makes a big distinction between this and the steel in my kitchen knife or, the girders in a skyscraper.
It does. To understand superbainite, you have to zoom in, way in.
Okay.
If you look at normal conventional steel under a microscope, you see grains crystals that are measured in micrometers. They're small, sure, but you can almost see the texture with a decent magnifying glass.
Okay, so small, but not microscopic small.
Right. Nanocrystalline bainite is a different beast entirely. It is produced at relatively low temperatures for steel, typically cooked between 200 and 300 degrees Celsius.
So it's a low temperature process.
For steel, yes. And this slow, low-temperature cooking process creates a structure that is incredibly fine. We are talking about platelets of ferrite that are only tens of nanometers wide.
Tens of nanometers. So we are orders of magnitude smaller than conventional steel. Why is making it smaller make it better?
That comes down to something called the Hall-Petch relationship.
Okay.
It's a fundamental rule in material science. Simply put, the smaller the grains, the harder it is for the material to deform.
So it's stronger.
Much stronger. Think of it like trying to run through a maze. If the corridors are long and wide, you can run fast and gain momentum.
Right.
If there are walls every 2 feet, you're going to move very slowly.
And in this analogy, the walls are the grain boundaries.
Exactly. The grain boundaries stop the defects, called dislocations, from moving. If the defects can't move, the metal doesn't bend or break easily, it becomes strong.
That's a great way to visualize it. But this isn't just a block of one thing, is it? The thesis describes it as a composite.
Yes, and this is the magic recipe. It's a mix of two distinct phases.
Two things.
First, you have those tiny, hard platelets of bainitic ferrite. That gives you the raw strength we just talked about.
Okay.
But if you only had that, the steel would be like glass strong, but it would shatter if you hit it with a hammer.
Which is pretty bad if you're trying to make armor or structural beams. You want it to take a hit.
Very bad. So in between those hard platelets, you have films of something called retained austenite.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't austenite usually something you only see when steel is glowing red hot?
That's right.
Like when a blacksmith is hammering a sword on an anvil?
Typically, yes. Iron changes its crystal structure at high temperatures to become austenite. Usually when it cools down, it transforms back into ferrite.
But not here.
But in super bainite, through some very clever alloy design, adding massive amounts of carbon and silicon, they manage to trick the steel.
They trick it.
They do. They suppress the transformation just enough to keep some of that high-temperature austenite stable right down to room temperature.
Wow.
It's essentially frozen in a state it shouldn't be in.
So it's frozen in time, in a way.
In a way. And that retained, austenite acts as a cushion. It's softer and more ductile than the ferrite.
Ah, okay.
So you have the ferrite plates for strength and the austenite films acting like shock absorbers between them. That gives you toughness.
Strength and toughness, the holy grail. Usually in material science, you have to pick one, right?
You do.
If you make it hard, it breaks. If you make it tough, it bends.
Precisely. That is the eternal struggle. Super bainite gives you both.
And there's more.
And the kicker, which the thesis highlights, is that you don't need insane processing to get it. A lot of high-strength metals require rapid quenching.
The beat it until it submits method.
Exactly. Or smashing them with giant rollers to crush the grains. But super bainite forms this nanostructure naturally through a phase transformation.
So you can make big pieces.
You can produce it in bulk, huge blocks of it, just by holding it at a specific temperature in an oven. The abstract even mentions it has been commercially developed for armor plating.
So let's recap the resume of this material. It stops bullets, it holds up buildings, it's cheap to make, and you can make it in big chunks. It sounds perfect.
It does.
Why aren't we building everything out of this? Where does it go wrong?
It goes wrong when you introduce heat. And we aren't talking about the melting point of steel, which is up over 1,500 degrees.
No, we're talking about much lower temperatures.
We were talking about relatively modest temperatures, around 400 or 500 degrees Celsius.
Which, in the grand scheme of industrial machinery, isn't actually that hot.
Not at all.
A car engine, a jet turbine, even some friction processes get hotter than that easily.
Exactly. If you put super bainite in that environment, it begins to die. The problem lies in that retained austenite we just praised for providing the toughness.
Okay.
The thesis describes it as metastable.
Metastable. That sounds like a scientist's polite way of saying ticking time bomb.
That is shockingly accurate. In a thermodynamic sense, it is waiting to explode. The austenite is happy enough at room temperature, but it is chemically overloaded with carbon. It's holding way more carbon than it theoretically should be able to. It's like a sponge that is soaked up twice its weight in water.
And the heat squeezes the sponge.
Perfectly put. The heat provides the energy for the atoms to move. When you add thermal energy, that trapped carbon thinks, I don't want to be stuck in this austenite anymore. I want to go somewhere more comfortable. It wants to reach equilibrium.
So the carbon breaks out. What happens to the structure when the carbon leaves?
The austenite decomposes. It stops being austenite. It transforms into a ferrite and a carbide called cementite.
And here enters the villain of our story.
Mm-hmm.
Cementite, Fe3C.
In this context, yes, it is the villain. Cementite is a ceramic-like phase. It is very hard, but it is extremely brittle.
Okay.
Imagine replacing those rubber shock absorbers in your car with solid glass rods.
You hit one pothole and the whole suspension shatters.
Exactly. When those films of tough austenite break down into cementite, the material loses that cushioning effect.
Yeah.
It becomes brittle.
And
the thesis confirms that previous work showed this decomposition makes the material weak and prone to catastrophic snapping.
So if you want to use this super steel in a jet engine component, you have a major problem.
A huge problem.
You start the engine, the part heats up, the austenite turns into brittle cementite, and suddenly your high-performance gear isn't so high-performance. It might actually shatter mid-flight.
Precisely. And that is obviously unacceptable for aerospace. So the goal of Christopher Holmes-Smith's research was to stop this decomposition. He needed to find a way to keep the austenite alive, even when the heat was turned up.
Okay, so let's look at the first plan of attack. Strategy number one. The logic seems pretty straightforward.
It does.
If cementite is the bad guy, let's stop the cementite from forming.
That was the initial approach, and it's a very standard metallurgical strategy. We know that certain elements hate being inside cementite.
Okay.
Silicon is the most famous one. Silicon is very low solubility in the cementite crystal structure.
So silicon is like a barrier.
Think of silicon as a chemical stiff arm. If you have a lot of silicon in the steel, it makes it energetically very difficult for cementite to form. The silicon atoms physically get in the way.
I see.
The theory was, if we add enough silicon, we can prevent the cementite from precipitating.
And if cementite can't form, the carbon has nowhere to go.
Exactly. If the carbon has nowhere to go, it has to stay in the austenite. And the austenite stays stable. It's a containment strategy.
Like locking the door so the carbon can't leave the house.
That's a good way to put it.
Did it work?
To a degree.
Yeah.
The thesis discusses Alloy 1, which used this high silicon approach. It did show a noticeable improvement in thermal stability compared to older alloys. But
there's always a but.
It wasn't a total fix.
The dam eventually broke.
Yes. At higher temperatures, or if you left it hot for a long time, the thermodynamic drive is just too strong. The chemical pressure for the carbon to escape becomes overwhelming.
So it wasn't enough.
It turns out that while silicon delays cementite, it doesn't prevent the austenite from eventually decomposing. The carbon eventually finds other ways to leave, or the silicon barrier is overcome.
So strategy one, block the cementite, was a partial success, but not the breakthrough they needed for extreme environments. It bought them time, but it didn't solve the fundamental instability.
Correct. And this failure led to the pivot in the research. And I have to say, this pivot is where the thesis gets really interesting conceptually.
Okay.
It shows how science often works. You hit a wall, so you change the question.
I love a good pivot. What did they change?
The researcher decided to stop fighting the cementite directly. The thesis describes a shift in thinking. Instead of resisting cementite precipitation, the new goal was to tolerate it.
Tolerating it? That sounds like a compromise. How do you tolerate the thing that is destroying your toughness?
By changing the rules of what makes the austenite stable, they developed new alloys, specifically referred to as alloys 8 and 9 in the text.
Right.
The secret ingredient here was nickel.
Nickel? Okay. I know nickel is used in stainless steel, but what is it doing here?
Nickel is what we call an austenite stabilizer. But it works differently than carbon. Carbon stabilizes austenite by jamming up the lattice like stuffing a suitcase so full it won't close.
Uh-huh.
Nickel, on the other hand, changes the fundamental thermodynamics of the iron itself. It makes the face-centered cubic structure, that's the shape of austenite, more energetically favorable.
Okay, let me try to map this out. In the first strategy, they tried to keep the carbon locked inside to keep the austenite alive.
They did.
In the second strategy, they are saying, what?
Go ahead and leave.
Exactly. They're saying, fine, carbon, you want to leave. Go form cementite. We don't care.
That is bold, because previously, carbon leaving meant the austenite died.
It did. But here, they added so much nickel that the nickel steps in and says, I've got this. The nickel holds the austenite structure together even as the carbon drains out of it. It acts as a backup stabilizer.
That is brilliant. It's like reinforcing the walls of a building with steel beams. That's the nickel, so that even if the bricks, the carbon fall out, the building doesn't collapse.
That is a very apt analogy. You essentially decouple the presence of carbon from the stability of the crystal structure.
You let the bad thing happen.
You allow the chemical reaction, the cementite formation to happen, but you prevent the structural collapse, the austenite to ferrite transformation that usually follows.
And did the results back this up? Did alloy 8 and 9 actually survive the heat?
They did. The source states that this nickel-rich alloy could survive exposure to elevated temperatures with the majority of austenite being retained.
Wow.
They conducted tests where they heated these alloys to 480 degrees Celsius and held them there for 8 full days.
480 for 8 days. That's basically an eternity in an engine cycle.
It is a severe test.
Right.
And while there was some reduction in properties, you can't completely ignore physics, and some carbides did form. The alloys retained comparable strength, toughness, and fatigue performance to the original superbainite.
So they did it.
They successfully created a version of this super steel that doesn't fall apart when things get hot.
So they solved the problem by changing how they define the solution. They stopped trying to banish the villain and just made the hero, austenite, immune to him.
In a manner of speaking, yes. It highlights the power of understanding the specific role of each alloying element. Silicon manipulates the carbon. Nickel manipulates the iron lattice.
And by balancing them,
you get the behavior you want.
Now, we need to talk about how they figured this out, because we are talking about atoms moving around inside a solid metal block. You can't exactly see that with a magnifying glass.
No, not even a normal microscope.
Or even a normal microscope.
And even a standard electron microscope would struggle to see these dynamic changes in real time inside the bulk of the material to really see what was happening.
Yeah.
They used synchrotron X-ray diffractometry?
Synchrotron, that is a cool word. For those who don't know, we are talking about a particle accelerator, right?
Yes. They used facilities like DE SciUp in Germany and the Diamond Light Source in the UK. These are massive rings, kilometers in circumference, that accelerate electrons to near light speed.
Okay.
When you bend those electrons around a corner using magnets, they scream out incredibly bright, high-energy X-rays.
It always blows my mind that we use the biggest machines on Earth to look at the smallest things on Earth.
It is necessary when you need high-resolution data from deep inside a chunk of steel. Standard X-rays just bounce off the surface or aren't bright enough to give you the data fidelity you need.
Right.
They needed to measure changes in the atomic lattice, spacing down to fractions of an angstrom.
And it was using these heavy-duty tools that the researcher found something quite surprising. This is the surprise twist in Chapter 10 of the thesis.
Correct. The twist concerns the crystal structure of the ferrite itself. Now, I need to take you back to Material Science 101 for a second.
Okay, ready.
Standard textbooks teach us that ferrite, the iron at room temperature, has a body-centered cubic lattice, BCC.
Cubic, like a perfect box, equal sides.
Right. A cube with an atom at each corner and one in the very center. However, when they analyzed this high-quality diffraction data from the superbainite, the peaks didn't line up perfectly with a cubic structure. The data suggested that the lattice was actually body-centered tetragonal, BCT.
Tetragonal. So that's like if I took that perfect tube and stretched it upwards.
Exactly. Stretched along one axis. Now, why does this matter?
Yeah, why does it?
Because we know another phase of steel that is tetragonal. Martensite.
Martensite. That's the really hard, brittle stuff you get when you quench steel rapidly in water.
Yes. And the reason martensite is tetragonal is because it traps a huge amount of carbon in the lattice. The carbon atoms get stuck in the gaps between the iron atoms and force them apart, stretching the cube into a tetragon.
But bainite isn't supposed to do that, right? The textbooks usually say bainite forms differently.
This is the heart of a massive, decades-long debate in metallurgy called the bainite controversy.
Wait, there's beef in the metallurgy community?
Oh, absolutely. It gets quite heated. One camp believes bainite forms by diffusion. That means the atoms hop around individually and rearrange themselves.
Okay.
If that were true, the carbon would have plenty of time to escape the ferrite, and the lattice would relax back into a perfect cube.
But if it's tetragonal?
If it is tetragonal, it implies the carbon is trapped inside the lattice. This strongly supports the opposing theory, that bainite forms via a displacive or shear mechanism.
Displacive.
Think of a deck of cards. If you push the top of the deck, the whole deck slides or shears.
Ah, I see.
The atoms move in a coordinated shift all at once. It happens incredibly fast, at the speed of sound within the crystal. Because it happens so fast, the carbon doesn't have time to get out. It gets trapped.
Stretching the lattice.
And stretching the lattice.
So finding this tetragonal structure in bainite is like finding a smoking gun in this argument.
It is significant evidence. The thesis claims this was the first evidence of its kind regarding the symmetry of the ferrite lattice in this specific material. It suggests that superbainite is chemically and structurally much closer to martensite than previously assumed.
It's essentially just a different flavor of martensite.
It's essentially martensite that formed at a slightly higher temperature.
That is a huge insight. It connects the dots. It explains why this material is so strong that trapped carbon strains the lattice, making it harder for defects to move.
Exactly. But it also explains the instability. That trapped carbon is desperate to get out. The very thing that gives it the super strength, the trapped carbon and the strained lattice, is exactly what makes it vulnerable to heat.
It's all connected. The strength and the weakness come from the exact same atomic feature.
Thermodynamics always demands its due. You can trick the atoms into a high energy state to get great properties, but eventually they will try to return to a lower energy state. That is the fundamental struggle of material science.
So, to recap the journey this thesis took us on, we started with a material, superbainite, that promised incredible strength and toughness without expensive processing.
Mm-hmm.
But it couldn't handle the heat because its secret weapon, austenite, would decompose?
Right. The researcher first tried to block the decomposition product using silicon. That didn't work well enough.
Yeah.
So they pivoted to stabilizing the material with nickel, essentially making the material tolerant of the decomposition.
They saved the structure by reinforcing it.
They did.
And along the way, they used some of the most advanced X-ray sources on the planet to discover that the atoms in this steel are arranged in a stretched tetragonal lattice, which proves that even in something as old as steel, there are still fundamental discoveries to be made about how it actually works.
It really emphasizes that steel isn't just one thing. It is a complex dance of crystals, carbon, and alloying elements.
And you can change the dance.
By manipulating these invisible variables, swapping a bit of silicon for nickel, changing the temperature by a few degrees, we can completely tailor the material. We can make it suitable for armor or for jet engines.
It makes you look at a simple steel beam or a car part a little differently. Underneath that gray, boring surface, there's a battle going on between thermodynamic stability and the mechanical properties we want.
And the fact that we can intervene in that battle is the essence of why material science is so exciting.
I will leave you with one final thought to mull over. We talked about tetragonality, that stretched box shape of the crystals. If bainite is actually tetragonal, just like martensite, it suggests that our rigid classifications in textbooks, this is bainite, that is martensite, might be a bit artificial. It makes me wonder how many other solved sciences are hiding complex secrets just because we haven't looked at them with a big enough synchrotron yet.
That is a very valid question. We are only just beginning to see what is really there.
That's it for this deep dive into the atomic world of steel. Thanks for listening.